This is Radio Omnibus, WFDU's celebration of the arts and literature. Today, host Jack McElligott presents Insight.
Hello, this is Jack McElligott, and welcome to Insight on WFDU-FM. Insight is dedicated to thought-provoking interviews with thought-provoking people. We'll be covering many facets of our culture, including literature, history, science, art, theater, and contemporary affairs. Today, we are speaking with Dr. Rick Hansen, the author of Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. Rick Hansen is a neuropsychologist and meditation teacher, a summa cum laude graduate of the University of California, Los Angeles. He co-founded the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom and edits the Wise Brain Bulletin. He and his wife have two children. Welcome, Rick.
Thank you.
Tell me, what gave you the idea of combining the studies of neuroscience and psychology with Buddhism and examining the workings of the brain?
It just seemed like ketchup and French fries. I mean, it just honestly seemed like the best possible combination, because when you've got three really powerful traditions, you know, Western psychology, also Western neuroscience, combined with 2,500 years of contemplative practitioners, you know, the Olympic athletes of mental training, if you will, having very deep insights into how the mind actually works. When you bring that together and you combine it, you've got a tremendous synergy. And also, when all three of these traditions seem to be saying the same thing, then you can really have some confidence in it. Plus, also, that's where you get fantastic methods, which is what my book's really about, methods for regular people in the middle of busy lives to, you know, make things better, feel less stressed, get less cranky, be more productive, be more loving, feel more at peace in a topsy-turvy world. So that's it. Plus, intellectually, it was just really interesting to think about what in the world is going on in the brain, and therefore the basis of the mind, when a person is in a very deep state of well-being and unconditional happiness. So that if you can understand what in the world is going on inside the black box, you know, the 3 pounds of tofu right between the ears, when a person is in such a good state that we all long for, of course, and touch occasionally but rarely have stability in, if you understand what's going on inside the black box, then you can do reverse engineering, and you can gradually promote the conditions that of those neural substrates, you can stimulate and therefore strengthen them, so that increasingly you find yourself just naturally settling into that greater and more stable sense of confidence and happiness and peace.
In your book, one of your key messages is, when your mind changes, your brain changes too. Please explain what differences there are between the mind and the brain and how the mind changes the brain.
That's a dead-on question. It's so great. Well, when things are messy, it really helps to be really clear about your terms. So I try to define my terms here. The brain is pretty straightforward, right? 3 pounds of tofu between the ears, or really we're talking about the nervous system broadly, you know, headquartered in the brain. That's material. It's made of matter. It's meat, frankly. Whereas mind is the flow of information through the nervous system. Just like a TV is a piece of hardware, but the sights and sounds and words on the screen and whatnot are all flows of information across the TV screen. So there's this distinction here between hardware and software, between matter and mind. Nonetheless, there's no question in Western science that you need the meat to, you know, make the mind. You no brain, no mind, right? What's exciting, though, is that these flows of causality, if you will, go in both directions. In other words, much as the brain makes the mind makes the brain. And it does so by changing the brain as information moves through it, both temporarily, as people follow this conversation, hear the sounds, look out the window, see the sights, think about other things, what have you, moment to moment, that mental activity maps to underlying neural activity. So that mental activity is calling upon and endlessly changing neural activity. Well, those temporary changes become lasting ones because, in the famous saying from Donald Hebb, a Canadian psychologist, when neurons fire together, they wire together. In other words, when mental activity drives neural activity, it leaves lasting residues in neural structure behind. That's why, for example, when, let's say, London taxicab drivers have to memorize the spaghetti snarl of streets in London, at the end of their training, the hippocampus, part of the brain that's involved in visual spatial memory, is measurably thicker. Or if people routinely do some kind of mindfulness practice, such as meditation, they build out the parts of the brain that are involved in controlling attention, which makes sense given that it's mindfulness, but they also build out parts of the brain that are involved in self-awareness, especially for body sensations and gut feelings. And those are parts, wonderfully, which are, of course, also involved in empathy for the emotions of others. So in those examples, and also in hundreds of other examples, the way we use our mind can change our brain, for better or worse. The problem is, in the Buddhist saying, that the mind takes the shape of what it rests upon. So, and that means the brain takes the shape of whatever the mind rests upon. So if a person is dwelling on their resentments or feelings of inadequacy or self-criticism, or endless worries about things they can't do anything about, the brain will gradually take that shape, alas, and become increasingly pessimistic, depressive, gloomy, and bunkered down, and so forth. On the other hand, if the mind routinely looks at the facts that are good, in other words, the good qualities in oneself, you know, nice things that are happening in the world, little accomplishments, small good moments as the days go on, then the neural structures that correspond to those mental activities will be stimulated and therefore strengthened, and a person will become increasingly resilient, confident, and happy. The takeaway point is that you can use your mind to change your brain to benefit your mind, and that gives people an incredible amount of power, if you will, and control. They have got to use it for, you know, to get the benefits, but in a day, you know, when people feel very buffeted, you know, by big macro events like, you know, the economy, Al-Qaeda, the politics, Fox News, whatever, you know, it's fantastic to feel increasingly that instead of kind of being a passenger in a car bouncing down the road, you can move over in the driver's seat, put your hands on the steering wheel, because the brain definitely is the steering wheel of how we go through life, and gradually take control.
Let me pick up on a thread there of that exposition. You state that the brain mind tends to focus on threatening and negative information, mm-hmm. and that's a primary tendency. What causes that, and is it possible to modify that?
Yeah, what caused it is evolution, and it's completely possible to compensate for it. The way evolution caused it is that as our ancient ancestors, you know, lived and passed on their genes, it was important for them to track both opportunities and threats, you know, both carrots and sticks. But if they missed a carrot today, they'd probably get a chance at one tomorrow. But if they failed to miss a stick today, whap, no carrots forever. That's why the brain has what scientists call a negativity bias. Or as I say, it's like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones. That's why, for example, research on couples has shown that on the average, it takes about 5 positive interactions to make up for a single negative one. And so that's, you know, given the negativity bias, the problem is that it's a great way to pass on gene copies. It's a lousy way to have quality of life. And so if we want quality of life, and if we want to see the world accurately, because in all the traditions and also in science, it's the truth that sets us free. It's by seeing things clearly, both the threats and the opportunities, that we make our way in this world in the best possible way. The problem is we're very tilted toward a kind of paranoid trance. In that, you know, evolutionarily derived tendency is then exacerbated by modern inputs of media and also, frankly, political manipulation that, you know, continually beats the drums of war, because that's a great way to get a very compliant populace. So the bottom line here in our own daily life is that it's really important to, A, try to see through that paranoid trance so that we, you know, don't make the mistake of thinking that there's a tiger everywhere or that it's always threat level orange wherever we go. And second, even more, I think, this is what the fourth chapter in my book's about, is to take in the good. In other words, to use the neural machinery of memory and trick it by focusing on good experiences for, you know, 20, 30 seconds in a row and force those neurons to keep firing and therefore force them to start wiring in a way that, in effect, turns the brain increasingly into Velcro for positive experiences and Teflon for negative ones.
Well, we certainly can add to our own suffering by the way we process information. Could you please explain the concept of the two darts?
Oh, sure. You read my book well. Let's see. Well, it's the Buddha's notion that as we go through life, there's always an inherent and inevitable amount of first starts. In other words, unavoidable physical and emotional pain. You know, drop a brick on the foot of a Buddha or anyone, it's going to hurt. Or lose someone you love, or have something threatening approach someone you care about. We're naturally going to become upset about that. That's the first dart of life. But then what we do, alas, is we throw second darts in terms of our own reactions to the first darts of life, and we even throw second darts when there's no first dart at all. In other words, there's just an event. You know, there are dishes in the sink, let's say, but then we get all worked up about why are there still dishes in the sink or something like that. And we even throw second darts when good things have happened, you know, when somebody compliments us and suddenly we start feeling guilty about it, or as if they, you know, if they only knew how bad I really was, and so forth. So those are the second darts of life. The good news is that while we have limited ability to, you know, we can avoid some first darts, but there's, you know, sooner or later life catches up with each of us, if only, you know, during the last year or day of our lifetime. But there's a lot we can do about the second darts, you know, by gradually getting control of our mind and, you know, as I said earlier, getting our hands on that steering wheel so we don't react in, you know, these needless and painful ways so much.
Well, there's another good analogy you made in your book, which I'd like you to share with us. And it not only explains a lot of people's personal conflicts, but also conflicts throughout the world. I found the analogy of the two wolves very striking in helping us to understand many of the problems we have today. Could you share that idea?
Yeah, well, it comes from a Native American story that always gives me the shivers. I'll just say it quickly here. It's a Native American elder was asked toward the end of her life, you know, why was she so popular, well-loved, why did everyone listen to her in council and all the rest of that? And she said, well, it's because I know that in my heart are two wolves, one of love and one of hate, and everything depends on which one I feed each day. And right there we have the human condition in a nutshell. In other words, through evolution, and there's a lot of really interesting science about this, which gets to the larger point that really in the last 10, 20 years, there's been an explosion of information about neuroscience as well as a growing intersection with these contemplative traditions. And we live in an historically unprecedented moment where we have access to this fantastic information. So one of the areas of study has been on evolutionary neuropsychology, and what's becoming increasingly clear is that we are both the most loving, empathic, compassionate, and altruistic species on the planet, and alas, we are also the most lethally aggressive species on the planet toward our own kind. And those two tendencies co-evolved in, you know, millions of years of evolution of hunter-gatherer bands, early hominids, even using stone tools 2.5 million years ago with brains a third our size. But those ancestors needed to survive. They needed to both have great teamwork within the band and very effective, aggressive, lethal competition between themselves and other bands. So we've got both wolves. The question is, what are we going to do about it? What I think we have to do is, one, be very careful about drawing distinctions between us and them. Because as soon as we do that, the wolf of hate gets up and starts pacing around looking for someone to bite. Instantly, we're in kind of a yellow alert condition when you make a distinction between us and them. And if you start to feel at all threatened by them, or start to feel that them don't count, they're not fully human, you know? For example, much as the Nazis did with the Jews and homosexuals and other groups during World War II, then instantly, you know, the wolf of hate is up and biting and snarling. The other thing we need to do, of course, is to feed the wolf of love and to really look for all those little ways in daily life to, you know, be empathic, to tune into other people, to regulate our conduct with other people, to increase the love in our own heart and appreciate the ways that it feeds us. It doesn't make us more vulnerable. It actually makes us stronger to be more loving. And then as we do that, take in the good, you know, my fourth chapter again, take in the good of those good experiences so that we gradually feed the wolf of love. Ultimately, I think the wolf of love is bigger and stronger than the wolf of hate, even though the wolf of hate gets a lot of news, right? But the wolf of love, even though we're surrounded by everyday cooperation, we hardly notice it. It's like a wallpaper. But, you know, I have a lot of faith in the wolf of love. But these days especially, you know, caveman brains armed with nuclear weapons, in a paranoid trance. We've got to be very careful of the wolf of hate.
Yeah, well, this just illustrates some of the differences between the brain itself and the mind, and how the mind can help the brain to develop properly and grow.
That's exactly right. People can become literally more compassionate, and the parts of the brain, the neural circuits that are engaged in compassion, can become literally stimulated and strengthened by routine practice.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Insight, and I'm your host, Jack McGilligan, and we're speaking with Dr. Rick Hansen, the author of Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. Rick, how would you define the state of equanimity, and how does it help us, and how can one attain it?
Well, equanimity, you know, the English meaning of equanimity means basically a state of balance and peace and non-reactivity. The Buddhist meaning is a little more technical and very useful. It's the idea that instead of calm, which means not having reactions, in equanimity, we're not reacting to our reactions. In particular, we're not reacting to the sort of initial moment of experience as either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Basically, equanimity is like a big shock absorber in the brain, and it's great, you know. So a way to develop equanimity, there are multiple ways to do that. You know, I wrote about it in my book. I actually have, I think, the better part of a chapter on equanimity. And one wonderful way to do it is to hold your experience in a much bigger space. You know, in other words, most of the time we kind of feel like we're just sucked into the movie of our life. We're up there on the screen with people, you know, stuck in a traffic jam or with some coworker doing something snarky next to us in the cubicle, you know, nearby. But if we can just pop out of the screen and find our way into the seats, you know, with some popcorn, watching that weird movie up there, holding that movie, right, in a much larger space, you know, with a theater the size of a football stadium, then, you know, we're much less reactive to whatever it is on the screen. And we can also appreciate that it always changes. You know, it always comes and it always goes.
In your book, you share an incredible story from the Jataka Tales, and people love to hear stories. In fact, that's one of the ways that the great teachers communicate their principles. And this particular story apparently illustrates loving kindness. Could you share that story and explain how it's beneficial to us?
Wow. Well, this story is, goes back to a, you know, a mythical time when animals could talk, much like a lot of other folk tales. And at that time, in an earlier lifetime, the Buddha was incarnated as a gorilla. So you just kind of buy the premise there. And then here's where the story goes, and I'll do it quite succinctly. At that time, a hunter entered a forest and got lost and fell down a terribly deep hole. He began calling out, but no one came to his rescue. Days passed. He grew increasingly weak, you know, starving and thirsty. But far across the forest, the Buddha gorilla heard his cries. Moved by compassion, you know, he raced over to help the man. So he peered down into the depths of the hole. The man looked up and said, "Gorilla, get me out of here." Now, the man didn't know that this was a Buddha, right? And so the gorilla said, "Okay, I'll help you, but first I have to roll heavy boulders down into the hole and practice carrying them out before I can lug you out." So the gorilla rolled a number of boulders down into the hole, one after the other, and one after the other, lugged them out. Finally, he said to the man, "Okay, I can carry you out now." So he crawled down, got the man, pulled on the vines, you know, the rocks and so forth on the sides of the hole, and finally, with his last ounce of strength, the gorilla pushed the man out of the hole. While the gorilla lay there gasping, the man said, "Thank you, gorilla. Now, can you guide me out of the forest?" The gorilla said, "Okay, man, I'll do that, but first I need to nap and regather my strength. Then I'll guide you out of the forest." So the gorilla went to sleep. The man started looking at the gorilla and thinking, "I'm really hungry. This is just a gorilla. Why don't I pick up one of these big rocks, drop it on his head, kill him, eat him, and then with the strength that I'll gain from that, find my way out of the forest alone." So that's what he did. The man reached down, lifted up a big heavy rock, and crashed it down on the gorilla's head. It didn't kill the gorilla, but obviously it woke him up instantly from his sleep. And the gorilla was stunned. The man stepped back in surprise that the gorilla was still alive. With blood streaming down his face, the gorilla looked at the man and realized what had happened. And then tears began to flow out of the gorilla's eyes. And the gorilla then said to the man, "Poor man, now you'll never be happy. And that's the end of the story.
That is really powerful.
It's amazingly powerful at many levels. For one, it's the capacity of the gorilla to not go to war with the man, to not have the wolf of hate leap up and, you know, kill the man with one blow, which the gorilla could easily do.
This really leads me to the question that I think that you're going to answer, Rick. An aspect of recognizing our limitations and increasing our well-being is the idea of unilateral virtue.
Right. In that moment, the gorilla was not reacting to what the man did. The gorilla was moved by his own code, including his own code of being, you know, compassionate. The other thing he realized is that he didn't have to be the justice system himself, that the results, the karmas, if you will, in this life, from the man's actions, were justice enough, and that the gorilla did not have to, you know, punish him in any way, did not have to get all caught up in his case about what a bad person the man was. You know, in other words, the gorilla didn't have to do what I tend to do if my wife bugs me or something. Or, you know what I mean? He didn't have to do that. He didn't have to go there. He could, and as a result, in a funny kind of way, it was enlightened self-interest for the gorilla not to go to war with the man and to have compassion for the man, because that's what made the gorilla feel best himself. And therefore, just as you said, the gorilla acted unilaterally, unconditionally, in terms of his own virtue. And that gets at a wonderful way to operate increasingly in the world. And although, to me, all the great teachers and the really wise beings function in this way, they're not driven by reactivity. In other words, there's an inherent freedom in how they deal with things, even very difficult things. Their virtue, their kindness, and their wisdom is not dependent on circumstances, but is rather, therefore, unilateral.
In order for us to exercise a unilateral virtue, though, we have to be able to, I think, acknowledge the situation we're in and pause and make choices. And I think that is where the mindfulness and meditation might assist us.
I think that's exactly right. And that's where I think about something that's not in the book, but is that, for me, I've been doing this a long time, for about 35 years, all forms of personal growth and spiritual transformation even boil down to three phases, and I summarize them as let be, let go, let in. And in the first phase, we have to experience our experience. We have to stay with it, as Pema Chodron says. We've got to bear it. We've got to feel it. We don't need to feel it for days or even hours or even necessarily minutes, but we've got to be mindful of it. The second phase is, at a certain point, you know, there's no longer any value, really, in feeling it. If anything, because neurons that fire together wire together unwittingly, for better or worse, you know, we're just doing another lap in hell. And every time we take a lap in hell, we deepen the grooves a little bit. So it's time to move on. That's where we go to the second phase, which is letting go. And then the critical third phase, which is after we've released, to replace what we let go of with some positive alternative. Most people, me included, like to skip over the first phase. I think that's what you were getting at in your comment and question there. But it's critically important to really honor that first phase of mindful presence with whatever is in fact the case. But then it's time to move on. And also, as I said, really focus on replacing, which is a lot about, you know, building new neural structure to gradually soothe and then take over for the neural structures that were involved in old pain.
How can the practice of meditation help develop mindfulness?
Well, meditation is the preeminent training of mindfulness. And there are many trainings of mindfulness, of course. And I think we can often kind of privilege these exotic words like mindfulness and make them seem very special. You know, watch your toddler in a park. That's mindfulness right there. Or go try, you know, fly fishing. There's a lot of mindfulness where you watch that fly bobbing up and down in the stream. There are a lot of ways to be mindful. That said, meditation in one of its many forms, or I think equivalent practices like yoga that involve a lot of mindfulness of the body, or even things like dance, are very, very good for training the brain. And literally, lots and lots of studies show that if you do routinely practice some kind of, you know, a regular training of mindfulness, such as meditation, which is what most of the studies are about, you literally can, A, build out the neural structures involved in controlling attention, and B, actually become more able to concentrate in meetings, particularly in the afternoon, you know, when you're tired, or keep paying attention to your spouse when you really don't want to think about what he or she is saying, you know, or hold your mind on a piece of text that you're reading, or keep your mind on your breath if you're trying to use it for meditation.
Yes, I agree with you on that. I mean, I do regular meditation myself, but I run, and I find running itself as a meditation.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. And people, I think, can run mindfully or run mindlessly.
Now,
I bet you run mindfully.
I try.
Yeah.
I really do. But it's something you have to be mindful about. Being mindful about mindfulness, and maybe redundant there.
No, that's right. Awareness of awareness, metacognition.
Now, let's bring this into a wider arena, Rick, and talk about the idea of self. You know, all of us can contribute to our growth, but then if each of us contributes to our growth, perhaps the world will benefit. Is the idea of self an illusion created by the brain? And if so, how do we let go of it without losing our so-called identity?
This is a super deep topic, deep end of the pool here, and one with a huge tradition. So I'll try to take a swing at this in a very succinct and summary way. So if you encounter the Eastern traditions, they will routinely assert things like there is no self. Yet, on the other hand, in Western psychological and philosophical traditions, it's just presumed that there is a self. And by that, I mean in the conventional, everyday Western sense, that there's, an I looking out through your eyes or hearing sounds. In other words, there is a being who is the unified, enduring, independent, and essential owner of experiences and agent of actions. That's the basic definition of a self. And the interesting thing is that, first, when people actually look at their direct experience of, let's say, walking across a room or going about the day or reaching for the salt, they notice that there's actually a tremendous amount of variability in how much sense of self is present. Second, there's a lot of change in terms of parts of the apparent self that are present. Third, the self that does seem to be there is very dependent on all kinds of conditions. And last, the sense of self is just a subset of the person altogether, which is to say a particular body-mind that has a unique history and also certainly has moral standing, you know, deserves our care, and has moral responsibility. I think, by the way, the distinction between self and person is extremely useful. So right there, people look inside, they go, whoa, there's no fixed self there. In other words, the notion of this fixed, independent, unified, unchanging self is just not true in your experience. The amazing thing also, and this is a super red-hot area of research these days, is that in the brain, you see the same thing, that there is no place in the brain where the self is. It's, you know, self functions are widely distributed. Second, there's no place in the brain that's just special for self. In other words, the parts of the brain that do self-related functions, like remembering, having a personal memory come up, or, you know, having a sense of using the will and so forth, the parts of the brain that get engaged in that also do 10 other things, if not 110 other things. If you think of the brain as this sort of streaming activity, self-related functions are just more flotsam and jetsam, you know, carried along by that stream. So all of that takes us to, I think, an understanding based on very, very modern, cutting-edge neuropsychology that's completely consistent with the insights of deep practitioners over 2,000 years ago. That, in other words, while representations or ideas of self arise in the mind and are therefore held in the brain, and in that sense they're real, that which they point to has this coherent, unified, independent, etc. self does not exist. For example, there are representations in the brain of horses.
We've got about a minute left here.
Yeah, and they're representations of a real thing, whereas there are also representations in the brain of a unicorn. Well, those are real representations of a mythical beast. In the same way, real representations of I, me, and mine certainly exist in the brain, but that which they point to, this coherent, unified, unchanging, independent, etc., owner of actions and owner of experiences and agent of actions, does not exist. Self is like a unicorn.
I know you really couldn't do justice to that question in the time we had, Rick, but thank you. You did very well.
Oh, thank you.
That is all the time we have for today's program, and I'd like to thank Dr. Rick Hansen, the author of Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. I'm Jack McGilligott, inviting you to join me once again on Sunday, May 16th, 2010 at 8 a.m. here on WFDU for our next thought-provoking interview on Insight.
This has been Insight with your host, Jack McElligott. Insight is heard on WFDU every third Sunday of the month at 8 a.m. on Radio Omnibus.